Cheers.
Cheers.
What's your drink of choice, by the way, usually?
Just whiskey, usually. A friend recently introduced me to something called Monkey Shoulder, which is a really nice whiskey, very smooth.
It's a blend, I know that one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, short bottle.
Yep.
Yeah,
awesome. So you're a big fan of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I'm away, I drink a lot of whiskey.
Welcome to the State of the Artist podcast, a show about creatives doing good for the world. This week, I catch up with Polar Expedition photographer John Bozanoff. John has photographed over 30 landings across 6 seasons in both the Arctic and the Antarctic regions. His Instagram account, @JohnBozanoff, has garnered hundreds of thousands of followers with his clean and authentic images of the polar regions. His goal is to share imagery that encourages the protection and conservation of this vulnerable and delicate part of the world. In this episode, we talk about how his journey into the polar regions began, developing his unique photography style, why his camera of choice is the iPhone, and the realities of being a full-time Instagrammer. I hope you enjoy this conversation with John Bozanoff.
John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Vic. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming down, man. So you just recently came back from one of your trips.
Yes, yeah, about a week ago. I arrived back in Wellington.
Awesome. And So where was this trip?
So I was away for around 2 months. And so we started in the western side of Greenland. And then after Greenland, came down to Iceland for a little bit. And then up to a place called Jan Mayen, which is a very small Norwegian volcanic island. And then we finished up in Svalbard, which is a Norwegian Arctic, basically. Just a small island group north of Norway.
Epic, man. I've got so many questions about that trip. But
yeah.
I want to sort of rewind a bit and start sort of at the beginning of your story.
Yeah, sure.
Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I grew up born and raised here in Wellington, yeah. And I've lived here for most of my life, actually.
Yeah.
So I spent a little time away. I was studying up in Auckland for a few years, and I spent a year over in Germany. But for the rest of the time, I've been based here in Wellington.
That's cool, man. I think one part about being a Kiwi is that you always sort of have that itch to want to do your OE or live or work abroad. And so do you remember around about what age that sort of hit you?
For me, I'm not sure really. I think I've always been quite a homebody, to be honest. And I quite enjoy spending a lot of time at home, which is ironic because now I'm living away from home for about half of the year. But I think it was just after I left college, I guess. So around like 19, 20, I kind of wanted to start exploring a little bit and doing a bit of travel. So I went over to Europe first with my sister, actually. We did a little bit of travel around Europe. And then I realized that I hadn't actually seen much of New Zealand. So after I got back, I decided to do a big road trip around the South Island.
That's cool.
To kind of get to know Aotearoa a bit better.
And where did photography sort of enter the picture? Was it during your Euro trip that kicked it off, or...?
No, it wasn't actually. It was later on. So I was up in Auckland studying osteopathy, which is similar to like physiotherapy or chiropractic manipulation. And I was living on campus up in Auckland, and I had a friend in my class who had the PIN code to the darkroom on the campus, like the photography darkroom. And by this stage, it was like well past its heyday. So it was basically just like this giant like empty room full of all this like photographic like all the chemistry and the papers and equipment, but nobody was using it. And so I just bought like a really cheap camera on Trade Me, like an old film camera, just kind of started playing around in the darkroom. And I think my kind of passion for photography developed from there. But that wasn't until I was like, I think 19 or 20.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. Like the shooting on film, developing your own film, I find has a really magical element to it, mainly because like you've got the chemicals, the smell, the red light, but then also once you sort of put that sheet into the development liquid, the image bleeds
appears
on,
and,
which you don't get with digital.
No,
and it's a real like it gives me goosebumps when I think about it. Yeah. Sort of seeing that image appear out of a blank piece of
paper.
It's
quite like a romantic process, I think, and it's very easy to kind of get like addicted to that as well, because it is like such a cool experience to develop your own film and pictures in that way.
Yeah. It's Do you still shoot film now, or have you gone all digital?
No, I'm exclusively digital now.
Yeah.
I was in love with film for years, and then when I kind of realized that I wanted to work as a photographer professionally, I realized that I had to transition over to digital. So I've been doing that for years. And yeah, I mean, I would love to get back into film, but I don't really have the time these days.
Yeah. There's also the practical element too, especially on your trips, right?
Yeah, no, with the work I'm doing now, film would never work.
Yeah, cool, man. So I saw on one of your Instagram stories, I can't remember, but was it your dad or your granddad had a CFARS book?
I'm incredibly impressed that you remember this. This was just like a small Instagram story. It was months ago that I put that on.
Yep.
But yeah, that was my grandfather. So yeah, recently I got my own Seaman's book, which is just like a book you use to kind of keep a record of all of the work you do at sea. Yeah. And yeah, and I was showing my mum and she said, oh, your grandfather had one of those as well. And so she went downstairs and she found his old one. So yeah, he worked as like a merchant marine for the Greek Navy, I think, for a few years. Yeah.
That's epic.
Yeah.
And did you ever have conversations with him or was...
No, he passed away when I was fairly young, so I never got to know him too well, to be honest.
Yeah.
So, yeah, unfortunately I missed out on that. But yeah, I know that, yeah, he worked on ships for many years. And also my great-grandfather as well. He was a seaman too, worked on ships.
Wow, so it's in the blood.
Yeah, I guess to some extent, yeah.
That's really cool. So I'm interested in sort of how the journey began of being a land-based photographer to then becoming a polar expedition photographer. How did that sort of start?
So yeah, I kind of had decided that I wanted to work as a photographer. After I kind of been doing a few of these road trips around New Zealand, I really fell in love with kind of landscape and wildlife photography. And I found myself whenever I'd travel, I'd be doing it in the wintertime just because I feel much more comfortable in like colder climates and colder environments. So yeah, I realized I wanted to do this kind of work and I was just looking for jobs basically where I could work somewhere shooting this kind of content, but somewhere cold as well. And then I found out about kind of like this industry and that there's ships going down to Antarctica and up to the Arctic and that some of them had photographers on board. So yeah, kind of went from there. I just did like a lot of research and slowly built up a portfolio of the kind of pictures I wanted to be taking and then approached a few of these companies.
Cool. So the first one, that first sort of job that where you were able to go on a ship and head somewhere north or south, really far away. What was that company and I guess what was the process like applying for that job?
Actually, before I got a job, I got a scholarship to go down to the New Zealand subantarctic islands. And that was with a company called Heritage Expeditions. So just south of New Zealand, kind of like between New Zealand and Antarctica, there's a bunch of kind of small island groups. And they're uninhabited islands, or for the most part, there's a few scientists down there. But yeah, just like incredible wildlife, you know, thousands of penguins and seals and things like that. So that was my first experience on like an expedition vessel, but I wasn't working there. I was just got a scholarship to take some photos. And so I really fell in love with it after that. And so I think it was only a few months later that I got my first job going down to Antarctica. So this is the same company that I still work with now called Poseidon Expeditions. And I've been with them for the last 3 years.
Oh, wow. Because how many of these trips have you gone on so far?
We have one Antarctic and one Arctic season every year. And I've been working for 3 years, so a total of 6 seasons. But in terms of like actual trips, like back and forward between port, be somewhere around 30 or 40, I guess. Yeah.
Oh my God, that's a lot. So if your average traveler who's never been to the Arctic, I guess, thinks about going to the Arctic, there's all these things that enter my mind at least, like logistics, timetable, packing, risks.
Yeah.
And you've done a lot of these trips now. And I'm curious, what's your sort of mental game and your mindset like before you go on one of these trips now?
I mean, there's certainly a lot of prep involved, especially with packing. Like I have a huge packing list. And also because you're in such a remote area, if some of your gear breaks or you lose something, you don't have an opportunity to replace it, or at least not quickly. You know, it might be a few weeks or a few months before you're able to replace something. So I try and have multiple of a lot of things that I take. But yeah, in terms of prep, there's not a whole lot that I do really. It's just making sure that I've got all the right equipment and my phone and my laptop are all nice and clean, like there's not full with, you know, a bunch of files and everything. And yeah, it's not a whole lot really. Just making sure I've got the right clothing, got the right camera gear.
True, and I guess before you go on a trip, because you've taken a lot of photographs or you started cataloging certain species of penguins and seals, do you go on one of these trips with a game plan of, I really want to try to get this animal that I didn't get last time and I want to get this angle of this animal that I didn't, you know? Like,
certainly is to that extent. Like last season in Antarctica, for example, I really focused on shooting with a super wide angle lens because for a long time I'd been shooting pictures of penguins and seals with a 24 to 70 millimeter, which is kind of like a wide angle to medium focal range for a lens. But last time I went down, I was shooting with a super wide 15 to 30. So it means getting quite a bit closer to the wildlife. But yeah, there's like a number of species that I haven't seen or haven't seen many times. And so I'm always crossing my fingers that we encounter them, but it's just so much luck involved. So emperor penguins, for example, I've only seen one emperor penguin. I would love to see more. But
is it because they're sort of deeper inland? Or
A lot of them are further south. And the northerlymost colony of emperor penguins is on a place called Snow Hill Island. And Snow Hill is it's notoriously difficult to access. You need like an icebreaker and a helicopter to get to it.
Oh, wow.
So my only opportunity to really see emperor penguins on the western side of Antarctica, the part that I visit, is really just to see a few like kind of migrant birds that might be a bit lost or out exploring a bit further.
Wow. Being in such remote and I can imagine super quiet landscapes, there's no sort of light pollution or sound pollution. Yeah, I mean, you've got a lot of time to sort of think about things, right, on one of these trips?
Not as much as you would probably think, actually. We are incredibly busy.
Oh, true.
Like the whole time I'm away. And so we don't actually get too much downtime or too much quiet time to just kind of sit and think and relax. It's kind of always like go, 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 go. There are like some moments, you know, we might get like half an hour here and there to kind of, you know, take everything in. But yeah, a lot of the time it's quite full on.
True. What's, I guess, a typical day, like sort of morning to bedtime?
Okay. So it's, yeah, so we probably wake up 6:30 to 7 in the morning, go into the dining room and have breakfast. And then I'd say by 8 o'clock, we're expected to jump into the Zodiacs. So the Zodiacs are the small, like inflatable boats that we use to kind of travel between the ship and the shore. And so, yeah, then we have a morning landing that will usually go from like 8 a.m. to say 11 or 11:30. We're back on the ship for lunch at around, yeah, maybe 12 o'clock, and then head back out in the afternoon at, say, 2:30 for the second activity of the day. And, yeah, probably finish that at around 5:30, come back on board. We have dinner and then, like, a meeting of some kind, and then I edit my photos in the evening, jump in bed at about 10:30, 11-ish.
Got it. And you're traveling to these places during the time of the year where there's no sunset, right? Is it daytime?
Yeah, so, so basically that's what the polar circle is. So, for example, the Arctic Circle, the definition is that anywhere like or north of the Arctic Circle will experience at least one 24-hour period per year of constant daylight and one 24-hour period of constant darkness. So in the Arctic, we go very far north, and for pretty much all of the time that I'm there, we will be situated further north than the Arctic Circle, so the sun doesn't set during that entire period. But in Antarctica, it's much further, much more difficult, sorry, to go further south. And so most of the time, we are actually north of the Antarctic Circle. And so we do have sunsets, but it doesn't get, like, properly dark. It's kind of like a constant twilight type thing.
Got it.
Yep.
Does that mess with your head at all?
In the Arctic, it really does. Yeah, it messes with your hormones a lot. Well, subconsciously, you don't really think about it, but you use daylight as a cue for time, and it kind of tells you, you know, the sun's going down, and your body kind of starts to relax a little bit, and you kind of maybe chill out in the evening, have dinner, and wind down and go to bed.
Yeah.
But in the Arctic, when it's constant daylight and the sun is constantly above you, you don't have that cue. And so quite often, you'll look at your watch and be like, oh my goodness, it's like 11 o'clock right now, I've got to go to bed, and you've just completely forgotten, you know?
Yeah.
So you just got to go lie down and try and sleep.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I'm curious about these trips. Have there been any crazy stories or sort of accidents on any of these trips?
That I've been on, there's never been anything too bad.
Yeah.
But the weather in the polar regions, it can change very, very quickly. And I've definitely been in situations where you might land somewhere and there'll be like, it'll be dead calm, no wind. And then within half an hour, it might be like gusting 50, 60 knots of wind. And the swell really picks up and everyone's got to basically rush back to the ship. And it can be quite stressful in those times. Especially if you're in a Zodiac, driving a Zodiac by yourself, because if you're kind of going into the waves while driving and you hit a big wave at the wrong angle, it can flip the Zodiac. And wow. So I've had colleagues that have come out of a Zodiac before.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it hasn't happened to me, fortunately.
Have you ever dropped a camera in the ocean?
No, I haven't actually. No, I've dropped my phone in the water, but...
Did you get it back?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, no, it wasn't too deep, luckily. But no, I've been actually very lucky. I've destroyed a few cameras just from water damage, but from that's with like waves coming into the Zodiac or just rain and snow that have damaged the cameras.
Yeah.
But no, I've personally never dropped one in the ocean.
So what's on your camera pack list? What camera do you rock?
So at the moment, my two main DSLR bodies are Canon 5D Mark IIIs. And the reason I'm shooting with those is just because the weather sealing on them is really good. So now the technology in them is quite old. But the weather sealing is really fantastic. So that's the main reason why I'm shooting with them as the main body. And then I also, I have a Mavic Pro drone that I use as well. I shoot on my phone a lot, so I'm shooting with iPhone 10 at the moment, and also an old GoPro, but I don't use that too often these days.
True. Yep. So the iPhone, I guess if people jump onto your Instagram feed, they'll notice that. Is it safe to say most of your photos, especially now, are shot on iPhone?
Yeah, within the past year or two, all of them have been iPhone photos.
Yeah. Yep. So can you tell me about sort of how that started?
Yeah, so actually, so like I said, I was shooting on film cameras at first, and I was using like very cheap, very simple, basic film cameras, and I quite enjoyed the process of shooting with them because it was so simple. And then I went on this kind of big road trip down to the South Island, and I was shooting on my iPhone down there because I was kind of just traveling and enjoying the moment and taking a few snaps on my iPhone 4S, I think, at the time. And I was putting them on Instagram, and I kind of started growing a bit of a following from there. And it was only like I was getting maybe 3 or 4 new followers a day. But for me, it was really exciting back then. I was like, oh my goodness, like people are looking at, you know, these pictures. And in many ways, the iPhone was very similar to those film cameras that I was shooting with. It was very, very basic, limited controls. I didn't have to think too much about what I was doing. I just kind of point and shoot. And even now, while I'm very competent, of course, shooting like with, you know, more complicated cameras, I still enjoy the simple process of using basic cameras and basic tools. And so, yeah, my love for like iPhone photography kind of grew from there, and it's still my favorite camera to shoot with.
Yeah. So on a typical trip, are you taking more iPhone photos or taking more DSLR or sort of equal?
Yeah, so for my employer, like for my job and the reason I'm there, I shoot on a DSLR, like all of those pictures, just because the quality and the resolution is much higher and they can do a lot more with the pictures. But myself, I probably shoot a similar amount on my iPhone as well. Just when I get like spare moments, I'll shoot everything on my phone.
That's cool, man.
Yeah.
I noticed some month or two, or it was actually before your last trip, that Apple had featured your work.
Yeah.
Tell me about how that came about.
Yeah. So they gave me a call one day, actually. My phone rang, and they'd just given me a call from over in California. I was like, oh, wow. It's like actually Apple calling me, which is really cool. They told me that they had a project idea for Earth Day that was coming up, and they wanted to feature some of my iPhone photography on Instagram for that. So, yeah, they called me up, and we did an interview and everything, and I just spoke to them about what kind of work I do with the iPhone and how I've been shooting with it in the polar regions for the past 3 years or so.
That's super cool. Yeah. It's such a huge feature.
Yeah, yeah, it's really nice. I was quite surprised.
And so I know paying attention to social media numbers aren't the best thing to do because you could get sort of hung up in it. But I am really curious when Apple did feature your work.
Yeah.
How did you notice what happened to your followers?
I don't think there's a significant increase from there. There's a lot of Instagram accounts that will feature the work of photographers that have quite a few million followers. And so my pictures have been featured on these accounts a few times. And I don't notice like a significant increase in followers when I get featured. You might get maybe a few hundred extra that day. But no, I find just like the gradual just growth from, I don't know, I guess word of mouth equates to much more than what I get from the features.
Consistency, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Cool. And so I think there's kind of like a romantic perception sort of about the life of a Instagrammer because you're a professional photographer / Instagrammer full time.
Yeah.
Is that safe to say?
Yeah, sure.
So can we talk a little bit about sort of what the reality is behind being an Instagrammer and what your typical week is like either on an expedition or even back home here in Wellington?
Okay. Yeah, I think this whole like Instagram influencer lifestyle is something that I was pursuing kind of before I got into doing this kind of polar expedition type photography. And I really love the idea of being able to travel all over the world and get paid to do it. And I've got a lot of friends actually that are doing this kind of thing. But I do think it is romanticized to some extent. Of course, like when you look at someone's Instagram feed, it is just a highlight reel of all of their travels and everything. And it's not always so glamorous. But at the same time, like it is a very nice job, you know, to be able to travel and see the world like that is something that not many people kind of have the opportunity to experience. So it is really cool. But but for me now, I think I've kind of found my niche in doing the kind of polar expedition photography, and I'm much more comfortable kind of focusing on that and trying to develop myself in that kind of field rather than doing more of the influencer type thing.
That's cool, man.
Yeah.
I notice your Instagram feed is very clean in terms of like, because there's a lot of influencers that do a lot of sponsorship deals.
Yeah.
And sort of, I don't know, maybe one out of every three or four or five photos is like a sponsored post.
Yeah.
And I notice you don't really do that so much.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about sort of the thought process behind that?
So it was something that I definitely used to do a lot of, but I just never felt entirely comfortable doing it, to be honest. I mean, I would always try and like feature or promote brands or products that I did genuinely like, but no, it just never really felt natural to me. I never felt entirely comfortable with doing it. So yeah, now I haven't done one in quite a while. But the people that do it, it's simply because it's their job. You know, it's like that's how they're able to fund their lifestyle and to continue to do it. But I get paid fairly well for the work that I'm doing now, so. I mean, I could earn extra money through it, but it's not something I'm overly interested in.
It's cool, man. I kind of like how you made that decision. When I look at your feed, I think, this guy's a pure photographer. Like, I respect him a lot more because of that.
Yeah.
So that's really cool, man.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'm sort of curious about jumping into what you've learned on all these expeditions.
Mm.
Because I can imagine a lot of people sort of hear about global warming. They hear about the ice sheets melting.
Yeah.
And you've probably seen a lot of this firsthand, right, with your own eyes?
Yeah.
Can we talk about sort of how that's impacted you?
Yeah, sure. So I think the thing is, when I first started hearing about global warming, and that's what they still talk about now, is that they say we're expected to see maybe 2 or 3 degree increase in global temperatures over the next 50 years or so. And it doesn't often sound all that significant, right? You know, going up a couple of degrees, we experience fluctuations in our own weather a few degrees every single day, and it doesn't seem like a huge deal. But the thing is, in the polar regions, and especially the regions that I visit, they're often sitting, or in the summertime at least, around 0 degrees Celsius. And so a fluctuation of 1 or 2 degrees is the difference between frozen water and liquid water, and these landscapes are mostly ice. So when you're increasing global temperatures by, you know, if it's only 1 or 2 degrees, that could bring your temperature just above freezing, and then everything starts to melt, which is exactly what we're seeing now. So even I've noticed it in the last 3 years. I've gone to Svalbard for the last 3 years, which is Norwegian Arctic, and every single year the ice, the extent of the Arctic sea ice is moving further and further north. And so usually what we would do is we would kind of, on our trips, we'd go to the top of Svalbard and then spend half a day just going a bit further north to go to the edge of the Arctic sea ice, because quite often we'd see polar bears up there and it's quite exciting to go and look at them. But this year we didn't even bother because the sea ice was like 300 kilometers north of Svalbard, and we're like, it's going to take us 2 days to get up there and 2 days to get back. It's not worth it.
Are you saying that cycle happened in 1 year?
The same time of year, from the first year I went compared to this year, it was like the sea ice was a few hundred kilometers further north than what it was beforehand. And so, yeah, so I've seen waterfalls coming off glaciers. I've seen icebergs with waterfalls coming off them because they're melting so quickly. You see in Antarctica, the distribution of wildlife. For example, penguins that prefer colder weather and are more ice-dependent are being forced now to move further south. And you have more like sub-Antarctic penguins who are able to also move further south because the Antarctic Peninsula is warming up. So yeah, I've only been doing it for a few years and I've already seen some changes.
Wow.
Yeah.
And has this sort of affected your mission at all, I guess, if you do have a mission?
Yeah, like seeing it firsthand compared to, because I still spend half of my time in the city and it's so easy to become completely disconnected from like our natural world when you're here because you don't really see any of it. But when I'm away, you see how our actions and our decisions impact what happens in these natural environments and how it affects the wildlife. It's very frustrating to see, but it makes me like incredibly passionate as well about wanting to protect these animals. So I think for now, I feel like my work does have more of a purpose because I'm able to kind of document these animals that not many people get to see. And they're really some of the animals being the most affected by climate change so far. I mean, we're kind of just at the start of it. And these are the first animals that are kind of really experiencing it to a large extent. So yeah, I do feel like now I've kind of, because I'm one of the few people that has the opportunity to go and see them, that it's kind of my job now to share the stories of these animals and show people what we have there and the vulnerability of these landscapes and the animals there.
That's really cool. So how many years have you been doing this so far?
Yeah, so it's about 3 years in total. I started at the end of 2015, and I'll be heading back down to Antarctica in mid to late October of this year for the fourth time.
Cool. Yeah. So this recent trip that you came back from, any exciting stories from that trip?
It was a very different experience to all of my other trips, actually. It was my first time going to the western side of Greenland, and it's a very cultural part of the Arctic. Like, there's a lot of settlements and like Greenlandic villages there. So it's my first time kind of seeing people that live in these environments. But I think my favorite part of the latest trip was landing on Jan Mayen. So Jan Mayen is a very isolated island. It's kind of halfway between Iceland and Svalbard, and it kind of just sits by itself in the North Atlantic. And very few people get to land there because the weather there is always like really, really rough. And yeah, we were just very lucky on the day that we went that we happened to have calm weather. But I think, yeah, we were only the second ship that had been able to land this year. And it was an incredible experience, like beautiful black sand beaches and quite a unique landscape as well.
Wow. Were there animals?
Mostly just birds. Oh, yeah. But no, nothing else really.
Very cool, man. You probably have heard this a lot, which is when you take a beautiful photo, the first question people ask is, oh, what camera did you shoot that on? Yeah. And it's kind of the typical thing to ask. But I think a lot of photographers have a lot of intention and they really think about the story they want to tell and the framing of the photo. And then even in post-processing, there's a lot of thought processes that go on.
Yeah.
When you're in one of these regions and you see a seal or a penguin and you're looking to frame up your shot, can you talk a little bit about how you approach taking a photo?
Yeah. So I remember hearing this lady speak a while ago, and she's talking about people who are wanting to get into a creative field, like photography, for example. And she was saying, well, I think now like the technology has got to the point where it's not particularly difficult to be like a half-decent photographer. The equipment is becoming like cheaper and cheaper, it's easier to access, and there's so many great like kind of tutorials and things online so that you can learn. And so this lady was talking about, how do you differentiate yourself from everybody else, right? Especially with photography, when it's not like illustration or painting where there's kind of, you can choose your own style, you know, so easily. And she was kind of saying the difference between you and everybody else is the person taking the picture. So if you kind of try and put yourself into your work in some way and have it as being like a reflection of you, then it's going to be different to everyone else because, of course, you're not the same as everyone. And so that's something that I kind of really took on board. So I think my work is very much a reflection of my personality in many ways. So I like to keep things very, very simple in my life. Like, I do everything I can to simplify my life in every way. So like reduce the amount of decisions I have to make every day. And I try and live with as few possessions as I possibly can, just enough to facilitate the life I want to live, basically. And so I think, yeah, when it comes to my photography, I take that into it as well. I try and I think about my frame and I exclude anything that I think isn't going to be necessary or like relevant or to help push forward the narrative that I'm trying to tell. And yeah, I also, often when you see groups of animals or penguins, for example, or seals, they are often in quite large groups. And so I'll usually try and look for one that's kind of sitting maybe a bit to the side by itself and just kind of focus in on that one and exclude everything else to bring the focus like right to that animal.
That's really fast. Thanks for sharing that. It's really cool hearing sort of how you approach. I never even thought about that sort of, because you're right, there is an abundance of photographers in the world. And sort of figuring out your own unique style is, I think, the biggest challenge for most people.
Yeah. And I think, so even now, I look at a lot of other photographers' work and I look at it and think, that's absolutely beautiful. That's gorgeous. But I don't want to copy it because it's not me, right? Like, I don't see myself in that work. So I can still appreciate it without having any desire to include kind of elements of it in my own work.
Yeah.
So that's the way I kind of approach things now.
That's cool. So I guess if there's anyone who sort of sees your work and they're wanting to get into your type of photography, do you have any recommendations for them on where to start?
Yeah, I mean, if they were looking to get into the polar expedition industry is growing very, very quickly at the moment. So even though at the moment there aren't too many jobs available for photographers, and the ones that are there are kind of very competitive, but I think it's because it's an industry that's growing, you will see more and more positions popping up in the next few years or so. So I guess my advice, I mean, of course it's a very quickly changing industry, but I would say just try and build up a portfolio of imagery of the kind of pictures that you want to be taking. And that's the most important thing, really, is so when you put yourself forward to somebody, you can show them your body of work and show that, you know, you're capable and competent in taking these kind of photos. And yeah, I guess just practice a lot. Like all things, the more you practice, the better you'll get. So that's always my number one tip, is practice and play around and try new things.
Cool, man. Yep. And in terms of sort of your legacy or your end goal, have you thought much about that?
Not too much yet. I try not to look too far into the future, because there's so many different paths I could go down and so many variables that I'm not able to, like, figure that out, what my life is going to look like a few years down the line. So I kind of have some short-term goals. Once I've achieved those, I kind of look on to the next thing. So with my legacy, I think long-term, what I would say is that I hope that my photography would have been beneficial to the polar regions in some way, would have helped kind of people learn about them and kind of grow a desire to protect these parts of the world.
Awesome. Can I ask about these two short-term goals?
Yeah. So at the moment, it's basically just places that I would like to visit. So I said to you earlier that I really want to see emperor penguins. And so the part of Antarctica that I visit is called the Antarctic Peninsula. And that's the area immediately south of South America. And so we call that Western Antarctica. But on the eastern side, that's the part just south of New Zealand. And so there are companies that also go down there as well. And they encounter emperor penguins. So I think I would like to get down to East Antarctica sometime soon, so it's something that I'm working on. And the other one is I'd like to go to the North Pole, which I've just secured, actually. This morning I got an email to say that I'm confirmed to go there. So I think next year, around July, I'll be doing a few trips on a nuclear-powered icebreaker that goes directly to the North Pole, like 90 degrees north.
Oh, my God. Congrats.
Yeah. That's epic. I'm really stoked for it.
Wow. Mm. Man, thank you so much for talking about your work and your thought process.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Where can people find you online?
The best place is just my Instagram account. So it's just at John Bozinov, so JohnBozinov.
Very cool. Thanks for coming on the show. I've been a fan of your work for a long time. And if there's anyone who's listening to the podcast who wants to get inspired and a little bit humbled as well, and sort of see a body of work that is clean, unique, and shows you a part of the world that most people don't see, definitely check out John's work. And I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Cool. Thanks, Lee.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode. If you enjoyed listening to the show, I would greatly appreciate it if you can leave a review in iTunes. Next week, I catch up with another amazing and inspiring photographer, Carmen Hutter. She talks about her transition from fashion blogging to adventure and travel photography. I hope we can catch up then.